Time is 12 noon. The Stuart Brent Children's Book Club is proud to sponsor today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Inspire a lifetime love of reading. Sign up for the Stuart Brent Children's Book Club today. Giving a child a book as a gift is easy. Finding the right book is another story. 30 years ago, legendary bookseller Stuart Brent founded the Children's Book Club. Today it's still the only book club that selects books individually for each child from infant to teen. Therefore, you can be sure each selection expresses your values. If you're looking for that ideal gift for a child this holiday, enroll him in the Stuart Brent Children's Book Club. For information, call 847-441-9688 or visit stuartbrent.com. Membership helps inspire a lifetime love of reading. What more precious gift can you give? Sign up for the Stuart Brent Children's Book Club today and receive a fabulous Adventures in Reading membership kit, a $25 value, absolutely free. Call 847-441-9688 or visit stuartbrent.com. Stuart is spelled S-T-U-A-R-T. Stay with us now as 98.7 WFMT brings you Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a new monthly series presenting interviews with authors before a live audience. It's a unique collaborative effort of Chicago Magazine, 98.7 WFMT, and Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Susanna Clark, whose debut novel, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, is a New York Times and Sunday Times bestseller. It has been shortlisted for the Whitbread First Novel Award, the Guardian First Book Award, and was nominated for the 2004 Man Booker Prize long list.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. I'm Victoria Lautman, the host and executive producer of this. You all get brownie points for coming out on such a miserable cold day. And before I introduce my guest, I just really want to explain again that this is a monthly literary series. It's a joint collaboration between Chicago Magazine, 98.7 WFMT Radio, and the Looking Glass Theater. And I want to thank them all again for allowing this to take place every month. We are broadcasting live here from the stage at the Looking Glass Theater. We will be taking a break in about a half an hour, very short break. And at the end of the program, we will ask for your questions. And I would like for a few of you to have them. It'd be great. These microphones here in front are for that purpose. Susanna Clark will be signing books afterwards. You can buy them. They make great, all the heavy Christmas presents, kind of like that fruitcake you don't want to get, but much more enjoyable, I would say. You know, it occurred to me that if somebody said to you, I would like you to read this 782-page book, it is about early 19th century England. It involves a lot of dead kings, old battles. You get to hear a lot about the Napoleonic Wars. It's written in the style of Jane Austen and Charles Dickens. Oh, there are 185 footnotes. Here, read this book. What, the ingredients for the biggest bore of all time, biggest flop of all time. You'd think, forget it. It weighs about 2 pounds, by the way. I put it on my scale. Instead, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell has become a worldwide phenomenon. It has now been sold in about 30 countries. There are 500,000 copies in print. There are bidding wars on eBay. If you plug in the title, you can see people are, there's whole categories just devoted to this book. And it is really a testament to the incredibly inventive and in some ways very peculiar and fascinating mind of Susanna Clark, my guest today. Thank you so much for being here.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
She actually flew in from this with this horrible weather. You know, when you read a description of this book, and critics have tried to reduce it to one sentence, and it's usually something really bland, like Harry Potter for adults. It's about magicians in England. If you have read the book, you realize this is one of the most multi-layered, incredibly textured tomes that I've ever read. It involves real history and imagined history, class structure, race relations, politics, and of course there's a whole component of magic. And I guess I'm really curious about what out of all of this, the relationships, the people, the places that you've put in this book, what was your entry point when you sat down to begin writing it?
My first entry point was that after years of trying to write a more contemporary novel, I decided that I wanted to write a fantasy novel. And having thought about that for a while, I decided that I didn't want to set it in a wholly fantastic world. I couldn't quite, in my imagination, that didn't sort of seem to, it just didn't seem to sit right. But once I came to the idea of setting it in England, that literally grounded it. And I felt much more comfortable, and I don't know, it just seemed a more fertile ground for my imagination. The second, as it were, starting point, the part at which it really began to take off, was the part when I came up with the characters of Strange and Norrell. They weren't quite called that at that point, but it was two men who were always linked together in the public mind, who were always mentioned in the same breath, but who resented it, both of them, very much, because they thought they were completely different from each other. And once I'd got that relationship, everything sort of flowed from that.
I read a reference that you said you had actually had almost like a vision of a character in 18th century dress in Venice, surrounded by English tourists. Is this just part of the Susanna Clarke myth?
No, this is true. I had years ago when I was trying to write, I was reading the book Becoming a Writer by Dorothea Brand, an American creative writing teacher from the 1930s, I think. And she reckons you should write every day. It's a very good book. I highly recommend it. And one evening, as I was falling asleep, I had this idea of this man in 18th century clothes standing in a piazza talking to a group of tourists like himself. And the next day I sat and I wrote about him because he seemed quite interesting. And I decided he was something to do with magic and something rather bad had happened to him. But he himself didn't fully understand this yet. But that was as far as I got, and I couldn't think of anything else. I couldn't fit it into anything else, so I just forgot about it for years and years until I came up with this idea of this fantasy novel. I thought, I need these two magicians. I need these two magicians who are always linked together in the public mind. One of them will be a chap with a library. He will have lots of books. He will be a very sort of shy little man. Now, who would really annoy him? Oh, I know, the guy in Venice, because he was arrogant and sort of Byronic. Yes, those two don't fit together at all. Let's put them together.
Well, it's funny that you develop this one relationship between these two men, and they are so psychologically fraught. It'd be very interesting to put this book in the hands of a psychoanalyst and say, you know, tell us about these people. Each of the characters seems really well wrought. You have thought through as much the Norrell and Strange at the heart of the book as you have the relationship between Strange and his wife, for instance, Arabella. They seem like the Nick and Nora Charles of the 18th century. They're, you know, if they walked around with a martini in their hands, you wouldn't be surprised. Or a character like the fairy, evil fairy prince in this, the man with the thistledown hair who never even gets a name. Even this is a character, as magical and strange as he is, who we feel we get to know by the end of the book. How much of that actually developed as you were writing the characters, and how much of that was about something in your mind that you wanted to put on a page?
Character, I think like a lot of writers, I actually find character and character development, that is the fun part, and it's the part which flows for me. So all of this is great. I get a little seed in my mind, and it doesn't take much water for that seed to grow for characters. With Strange and Arabella, I was very much thinking of the sorts of relationships you get in Jane Austen between the heroes and heroines, and often between the married couples who are in the background, because sometimes you kind of almost feel, I don't know, like with Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy, or Emma and Mr. Knightley, almost like they would have been even more interesting after they were married, the relationship. So Strange and Arabella's relationship is more about after they're married, when I think it's when they get to know each other a bit more. But and the gentleman with thistledown hair was just a sheer delight to write, because he's just so over the top, and you can really let go, and he can be as ridiculous as you like. It's wonderful.
He's an amazing character, one of the characters I keep thinking about. Of course, at the heart of all of this, I mean, but with the characters, the history, and it really is sort of a historical fantasy novel. It's as much one book as it is the other. It's the magic that you've conceived that makes this, I think, so compelling to so many of us. And the idea that the sort of magic you're writing about has real parameters. It can be sloppy. You might do it wrong. A dummy could really hurt themselves if they were trying to do it. Mm. And it was very clear, and you make it clear in the book, that you had very, very specific ideas of what magic is capable of and not capable of.
The strongest pattern, the biggest influence on the magic in the book was Ursula Le Guin and the Earthsea Trilogy, because I always felt when I read that book, or those three books, that this, if magic really existed, it would have to be like this. It just felt, you almost believed it. It was so well described. And as you say, it was very, very hard. It was difficult. The boys who were learning it had to do these dreary lists of the, learn these dreary lists of the true names of everything. And it could go wrong, and it could change from place to place. And I thought all of this detail was wonderful. So I knew that in my book, magic had to be difficult in order to seem real. Because as soon as you make it like any other form of technology or human skill or knowledge, and you make it almost produce as many problems as it solves, then it seems that much realer. And the other thing, the other way that the magic developed, though, at first I was very nervous of actually writing any magic. I thought, how do I do this? The way that I did it was to sort of actually look at the war. And that I found that by reading, whether it's because books about military history are actually a bit dry and therefore that your imagination is sort of seething away at the back while you're doing this, I don't know. But I found that by reading about the actual problems that the Navy and the Army had and thinking, well, what sort of thing would actually be useful? I came up with slightly offbeat ideas, I think.
Actually, this is a perfect place to ask you to read one of those passages where you get a real good sense of the offbeat ideas that you come up with one of your favorite characters who we can talk about afterwards.
Yeah.
Lord Wellington.
This is a passage with Jonathan Strange and Lord Wellington. Strange has been sent out to Portugal, where Lord Wellington and the British and Portuguese army are trying to drive the French out of the country. And Strange has not had quite the reception that he hoped for from Lord Wellington. In fact, at the beginning, Lord Wellington isn't pleased to see him. He doesn't want a magician at all. But Strange has studied what's going on in the war, and he has decided that what might be useful is to offer the British Army roads by which they can travel about Portugal without wearing out their boots. And Lord Wellington, on the strength of this, has invited him to dinner. "Ah, Strange," cried Lord Wellington, raising a glass in greeting. "There you are. I have had three aides-de-camp looking for you all evening. I wished to invite you to dinner, but my boys could not find you. Sit down anyway and have some champagne and dessert." Strange looked rather wistfully at the remains of the dinner, which the servants were clearing away. Among other good things he believed he recognised were the remains of some roast geese, the shells from buttered prawns, half a ragout of celery, and the ends of some spicy Portuguese sausages. He thanked his lordship and sat down. A servant brought him a glass of champagne, and he helped himself to almond tart and dried cherries. "And how do you like the war, Mr. Strange?" asked a fox-haired, fox-faced gentleman at the other end of the table. "Oh, it is a little confusing at first, like most things," said Strange. "But having now experienced many of the adventures a war affords, I grow used to it. I have been robbed once. I have been shot at once. Once I found a Frenchman in the kitchen and had to chase him out. And once the house I was sleeping in was set on fire." "By the French?" inquired General Stuart. "No, no, by the English. There was a company of the 43rd who were apparently very cold that night, and so they set fire to the house to warm themselves. Oh, that always happens, said General Stuart. There was a little pause, and then another gentleman in a cavalry uniform said, We have been talking, arguing rather, about magic and how it is done. Strathclyde says that you and the other magician have given every word in the Bible a number, and you look for the words to make up the spell, and then you add the numbers together, and then you do something else, and then... That was not what I said, complained another person, presumably Strathclyde. You have not understood at all. I am afraid I have never done anything remotely resembling what you describe, said Strange. It seems rather complicated, and I do not think it would work. As to how I do magic, there are many, many procedures, as many, I dare say, as for making war. I should like to do magic, said the fox-haired, fox-faced gentleman at the other end of the table. I should have a ball every night with fairy music and fairy fireworks, and I would summon all the most beautiful women out of history to attend. Helen of Troy, Cleopatra, Lucretia Borgia, Maid Marian, and Madame Pompadour. I should bring them all here to dance with you fellows. And when the French appeared on the horizon, I would just... He waved his arm vaguely. Do something, you know, and they would all fall down dead. Can a magician kill a man by magic? Lord Wellington asked Strange. Strange frowned. He seemed to dislike the question. I suppose a magician might, he admitted, but a gentleman never could. Lord Wellington nodded, as if this was just what he would have expected, and then he said, This road, Mr. Strange, which you have been so good as to offer us, what sort of road would it be? Oh, the details are the easiest thing in the world to arrange, my lord. What sort of road would you like? The officers and gentlemen around Lord Wellington's dinner table looked at each other. They had not given the matter any thought. A chalk road, perhaps, said Strange helpfully. A chalk road is pretty. Too dusty in the dry and a river of mud in the rain, said Lord Wellington. No, no, a chalk road will never do. A chalk road is scarcely better than no road at all. What about a cobbled road, suggested Colonel Murray. Cobbles will make the men's boots wear out, said Wellington. And besides, the artillery will not like it, said the fox-haired, fox-faced gentleman. They will have a devil of the time dragging the guns along a cobbled road. Someone else suggested a gravel road, but that, thought Wellington, was liable to the same objection as a chalk road. It would become a river of mud in the rain, and the Portuguese did seem to think that it would rain again tomorrow. No, said his lordship, I believe, Mr. Strange, that what would suit us best would be a road along the Roman pattern, with a nice ditch upon either side to drain off the water, and good flat stones well fitted together on top. Very well, said Strange. We set off at daybreak, said Wellington. Then, my lord, if someone would be good enough to show me where the road ought to go, I shall see to it immediately. By morning, the road was in place, and Lord Wellington rode along it on Copenhagen, his favourite horse, and Strange rode beside him on Egyptian, who was his favourite horse. In his customary decisive manner, Wellington pointed out those things which he particularly liked about the road and those things which he did not like. But really, I have hardly any criticisms to make. It is an excellent road. Only make it a little wider tomorrow, if you please.
Susanna Clark reading from her best-selling book, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. The idea that you would take actual events in history, actual people in history. We meet Lord Byron, we meet King George III. Wellington plays a huge role in the book. And just kind of blithely, with what really is a lot of nerve and chutzpah on your part, decide, man, I'm going to add some magic here. You'd have to look for very specific places to do that. And the Battle of Waterloo plays very prominently. Were you really looking, where can I put some magic in this? How can I influence history with magic?
Yes. Yes, that's what I did. I knew that I would have to, for example, put Waterloo in. Because I suddenly thought, oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, you've got to have it, because nothing much else happened that year in the book. So I said, yeah, you really have to have Waterloo. So I sort of just read descriptions of the battle and sort of saw, you know, where will the magic fit? And I found this one really great thing, which is absolutely perfect, which actually was better explained by Strange doing magic to cause it than it was the way it actually happened. There was a part of the French army which simply got lost on the way to the battle. Or at least if he didn't get lost, for some reason the person in charge of it had it wandering around, first going one direction and then going another. Anyway, it didn't turn up. And if it had turned up, the battle would probably have been lost. And so, no, I tell you what, that wasn't Waterloo. It was the battle the day before, Quatre Bras. But if that bit of the French army had turned up, then the British and the Allies would probably have been defeated and Waterloo would never even happen. So it was great because I could suddenly slip Strange in and make him the cause of this. And it was just perfect. My explanation is much better.
Yeah. You use Wellington a lot. Wellington seems like a character that has been in your mind for a while. And on the website, if you go to the Jonathan Strange, Mr. Norrell website, very elaborate website, you can order e-cards, you can see all the press materials, and then you can also read short stories. And there is a story, Lord Wellington loses his horse, which actually it's interesting when you read that. And there was recently, I guess at the end of October, a story in the New York Times that, you know, the New Yorker, I think it was that you did. It was a New York Times.
Yes.
It was for Halloween.
Yes.
There's some real similarity. There seems to be an interest you have, not just in Wellington, horses. Again, we have to call the psychoanalyst about this, but in embroidery. And
yes.
This seems to be something which I remember from the Brothers Grimm and earlier folk tales. But back to the idea of Wellington. What is it about this man that compels you so much?
Back to the idea of Wellington. I don't know. He got a very tiny little walk-on part in a short story I wrote years ago called Mrs. Mab. And there was just something about him. I really liked him. And so I began to read more about him. And the more I read about him, the more fascinated I became. He was the sort of celebrity I think we don't really have so much now, because he was, we have these huge, enormous celebrities, but he was known for being good looking. He was known for the affairs he had. He was known for his stylish clothes. Women absolutely fell over themselves to get to him, and he saved Europe twice. You know, it's a pretty good record. Plus, he was very witty and had all these cool things to say. But the really great thing about him in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, it comes back to this thing about making magic real. However, Mr. Norrell is not, as a person, particularly impressive. He's just impressive for the things he does. Strange, on the other hand, is quite cool and charming. But when you stand him next to Lord Wellington or the Duke of Wellington as he becomes, nobody is going to look at Strange. He may be able to do the most wonderful magic in the world, but the Duke of Wellington is still the most glamorous person. And I think to be able to say, yes, magic is this thing that's been revived, it's very cool, but it's not the coolest thing on the planet. The coolest thing on the planet, as far as the British is concerned, is the Duke of Wellington.
Well, they're very blasé about it. Well, we'd like a road. Can you raise the dead? What can you do for us? Could you make some angels show up and pluck people from their horses? And, in fact, I think one of the scariest scenes takes place with Strange during the war. And to me, the scariest things were when people use magic to raise the dead, something that happens very earlier in the book with Lady Poole, but then later with the 17 dead, where are they from?
Neapolitans.
There's something about raising the dead, which even in the book, even by earlier magicians, is acknowledged as really pretty brutal. It's not the kind of magic you want to do. You only do it if you absolutely have to. It's imprecise. It's creepy. And then when these corpses come to life, they're speaking a dialect from hell. How scary is that? And in order to get them to understand and speak English, Strange has to spit in their mouth. I mean, the whole thing is really quite awful, but fascinating. And your references to hell, what happens in hell, and the land, the bitter lands on the other side of hell, are really something that I hope that you're going to come back to and explore in your next book. What is the? How are you coming up with these thoughts about hell? Well, Methodist minister daughter. Why did I ask that?
Yes, exactly. Well, I don't know. There was an awful lot about hell in my childhood, but I think one of the things about it's actually an interesting thing about how many British fantasy writers were brought up in clerical households, or who were like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, very strong Christians. I mean, I think there is something there about. If you come from a Christian or any religious background, it isn't that unusual for you to think that, first of all, there are worlds beyond the world we can see, and secondly, that our actions may have consequences that we can't quite perceive, have more significance on another level. Yeah, but it's also the fact that if you start reading about fairy folklore, then you soon come across hell, because hell and fairy were often thought, if not to be the same place, to have a strong connection. There's the idea that one of the things that fairies suffered from was that every 7 years they had to send hostages to hell. They had to pay a sort of tribute of actual people. So yes, hell comes up quite a lot in mythology, in English fairy folk tales.
Your descriptions of fairy in all of its different guises, because we're never quite sure if that's where we are, and suddenly the idea that it's all around us, it's on the other side of the mirror, it's in the puddle, that it really just takes a different point of view, and there you are, whether it is contorted ancient trees and, you know, people that you cannot possibly understand. There's like an insanity to it. Versus the King's Roads, where there's a description of, I mean, the other character who we kind of meet later in the book, the Raven King, John Usglass, who's created roads and bridges and canals on a scale that nobody could even imagine. That in my mind, I was trying to think of Piranesi. Mm-hmm. And you have created all of these different environments, and I wanted to spend more time in those.
Yeah, I just kind of took, I mean, I think Pyrenees is probably definitely one of the things I had in mind for the King's Roads. I mean, it is. I just took all the things I really liked, and I just pulled them together and shoved them in one book, whether they were supposed to go together or not, which is why it's ended up so big and kind of complicated. Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of fairy just being on the other, just very, very close, is also very authentic. Somebody on my local radio station, BBC Radio Cambridge, one of the presenters who knows a lot about the history of the county, said, "You don't actually have to go back that far in the English past to when every English field was inhabited by fairies. Every, you know, people actually believed you could get to, you could be lured away into this eerie world, and the danger was ever present." There was a wonderful story by a woman, that a woman told, who had gone for a typing job, I think probably to a farm or an isolated house, and it was winter and it was misty, and this must have been about the middle of the 20th century, and she was told the way to go home, but it involved going through a field to a certain gate, and she couldn't find the gate, but she kept seeing another gate, but she didn't like the look of this gate and she knew it was wrong, and only when she saw a farm labourer and she asked him, he pointed out the right gate, and it was really obvious, but she thought she had been fairy-led at that point. In other words, the fairies were trying to lure her off. And that's, you know, that's, put that next to the typing job. We're not very far into the past.
We are going to take a short break here, and we're going to come back. You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman. My guest is Susanna Clark, and we're talking about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Don't go away and don't move. We're going to be back in just about a minute.
You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman on 98.7 WFMT, focusing on noteworthy authors who have published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. Each month, the featured author will be the subject of a brief Q&A in Chicago Magazine, accompanied by announcements in the magazine and on 98.7 WFMT for the interviews, which take place Sundays at noon once a month at Looking Glass Theater. If you'd like to be in the audience for the next broadcast on January 23rd with Alexander Hemon, admission is free. Reservations may be made at 312-832-6789.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. My guest is Susanna Clark, reading from her best-selling international phenomenon of a book, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. This is a monthly literary series that is a joint production of WFMT Radio 98.7 and Chicago Magazine here live at the Looking Glass Theater. We do have an amazing season starting up in 2005. And just so you know, the next person on our list, January 23rd, is Alexander Hemon, who, of course, just won the MacArthur Prize for his book Nowhere Man and The Question of Bruno. So we are taking reservations for that already. Coming up later in 2005, Francine Prose, Jonathan Safran Foer, Michael Cunningham, and Sue Miller. They all have new books coming out, and you will be able to see them here. So keep listening to FMT, reading Chicago Magazine, and sign up on our email list afterwards, and we will keep you informed. We were just talking about the world of fairy, and the fairies in this book, they are so bad. They are so evil. You just can't believe it. Tinkerbell kind of gave us a hint of what fairies could do, that they might actually want to do you harm, that the tooth fairy, they're not all nice. They're not all leaving you money under your pillow. And the gentleman with thistledown hair and everybody else who we encounter in this book, really there's a good reason why Norrell doesn't want them around, although he does bring them back into our world. Susanna, there is an incredible story. It is from one of the 185 footnotes, some of which go on for three pages, but they're brilliant, wonderful things to read. Tell us about this particular story that you're about to read.
This is one of the footnotes which just sort of gives a little window into the world, which in a way Strange and Norrell are trying to resurrect, the world where there was a thriving, where magic really worked. And in the history that underpins the Regency events, that there was a medieval history where there was a thriving community of magicians and fairies, and this is a story of one of those magicians and his fairy servant. Simon Bloodworth's fairy servant came to him quite out of the blue, offering his services and saying he wished to be known as Buckler. As every English schoolchild nowadays can tell you, Bloodworth would have done better to have inquired further and to have probed a little deeper into who precisely Buckler was and why exactly he had come out of fairy with no other aim than to become the servant of a third-rate English magician. Buckler was very quick at all sorts of magic, and Bloodworth's business in the little wool town of Bradford-on-Avon grew and prospered. Only once did Buckler cause any sort of difficulty, when in a sudden fit of rage he destroyed a little book belonging to Lord Lovell's chaplain. The longer Buckler remained with Bloodworth, the stronger he became, and the first thing that Buckler did when he became stronger was to change his appearance. His dusty rags became a suit of good clothes. A rusty pair of scissors that he had stolen from a locksmith in the town became a sword. His thin, piebald fox face became a pale and handsome human one, and he grew very suddenly 2 or 3 feet taller. This, he was quick to impress on Mrs. Bloodworth and her daughters, was his true appearance, the other merely being an enchantment he had been under. On a fine May morning in 1310, when Bloodworth was away from home, Mrs. Bloodworth discovered a tall cupboard standing in the corner of her kitchen, where no cupboard had ever been before. When she asked Buckler about it, he said immediately that it was a magical cupboard and that he had brought it there. He said that he had always thought that it was a pity that magic was not more commonly used in England. He said it pained him to see Mrs. Bloodworth and her daughters washing and sweeping and cooking and cleaning from dawn to dusk, when they ought, in his opinion, to be sitting on cushions in jewel-spangled gowns eating comfits. This, thought Mrs. Bloodworth, was very good sense. Buckler said how he had often reproved her husband for his failure to make Mrs. Bloodworth's life pleasant and easy, but Bloodworth had not paid him any attention. Mrs. Bloodworth said that she was not a bit surprised. Buckler said that if she stepped inside the cupboard, she would find herself in a magical place where she could learn spells that would make any work finished in an instant, make her appear beautiful in the eyes of all who beheld her, make large piles of gold appear whenever she wished it, make her husband obey her in all things, etc., etc. How many spells were there? Asked Mrs. Bloodworth. About three, thought Buckler. Were they hard to learn? No, no, very easy. Would it take long? No, not long. She would be back in time for Mass. 17 people entered Buckler's cupboard that morning and were never seen again in England. Among them were Mrs. Bloodworth, her two youngest daughters, her two maids and two manservants, Mrs. Bloodworth's uncle and six neighbours. Only Margaret Bloodworth, Bloodworth's eldest daughter, refused to go. The Raven King sent two magicians from Newcastle to investigate the matter, and it is from their written accounts that we have this tale. The chief witness was Margaret, who told how, on his return, my poor father went purposely into the cupboard to try if he could rescue them, though I begged him not to. He has not come out again. 200 years later, Dr. Martin Pale was journeying through Faery. At the castle of John Holyshoes, an ancient and powerful fairy prince, he discovered a human child, about 7 or 8 years old, very pale and starved-looking. She said her name was Anne Bloodworth, and she had been in Faery, she thought, about 2 weeks. She had been given work to do, washing a great pile of dirty pots. She said she had been washing them steadily since she arrived, and when she was finished, she would go home to see her parents and sisters. She thought she would be finished in a day or two.
It's so frightening. The stories of the idea that people could be held hostage, could be enchanted against their will. When some of the people who are enchanted in the book try and talk, it comes out gobbledygook. They can't explain themselves. And it really is a very dark book you've written here.
I think so, yes. Yes, I do. I think there's a lot of darkness in it. I love books which have dark and light pushed up together, that have very light moments and very dark moments in quick succession. I really enjoy that.
The footnotes in the book, which have been the plague to some people and to others, you know, you realize early on you're either going to skip them or you're going to just dive in. And it's so much of what becomes kind of filler of great interest, like that story, takes place in these long footnotes. Some of them are very short. There are references to, you know, a whole library of books, a bibliography. There's probably 50 books that you've concocted that keep being referred to again and again. Early on in the book when I was reading it, I thought, this is really distracting, and it becomes almost like a graphic issue where the page is interrupted by this thing and it's taking away from the story into something else. But eventually they become part of the rhythm of the book, and I wondered how much of that was conscious on your part and how much of it was just, well, I can't cram it into the other 785 pages, so I'll stick it here in another place.
It was very clear to me, I think, always what I wanted to be a footnote and what was belonged in the main narrative. I'm pretty sure you can read the narrative all the way through and ignore all the footnotes, and the story is there laid out for you. But the footnotes were meant to, I mean, it's almost interactive. It's very much, if you're used to computers, I think the footnotes are fine because they just give you that little bit of depth. And particularly they fill in the story of the medieval world. I have to say that when I was writing them, I was doing... I wrote them largely for my own pleasure. I really enjoyed writing the footnotes. And I didn't expect that any publisher who picked this book up to publish it would agree to publish the footnotes. So in a way, I felt very free writing them because I really thought the first thing they're going to say is lop off the footnotes, you know.
Well, they've become part of, and I don't want to use, it's not gimmicky in any way, but it's about sort of the unusual way that this book came into being, both that it took you 10 years to write it, you were a cookbook editor in England before that, and, you know, we have three separate covers here to the book. You can see the original black and white, then there was the white with black, now there's this special holiday red edition. And the way that this book was born and brought to everybody's attention has just been so unusual. I want you to talk a little bit about that and the fact that you really never did expect this to see the light of day.
In actual fact, my agent, who I left it all in my agent's hand, the selling of it, and he tried two publishers. The first, I have to say, I think with some confidence, largely because the first publisher was actually his wife. And she turned it down, and so did the second publisher. And
are they still married?
They were used to that. It was really not a problem. They handled that very well. And so I think by that time he was actually getting a little worried because he had a very clear idea of how this book ought to be published, and he felt he was running out of British publishers to take it to. And when Bloomsbury said yes, they were, you know, he said they're very enthusiastic, but it didn't actually, my first feeling was one of great relief. It is going to be published. It wasn't that extraordinary a thing at the beginning. I got a lovely phone call from the editor who bought it. I was very happy. I'm not saying I wasn't, but I had no sense that there was anything unusual going on. It was only when I went down about 10 days later to London to see the publishers. And I met all these people in publicity, in sales, in marketing, who'd read huge chunks of it. And I thought, well, I've been in publishing for 20 years. I know this isn't that common, that people outside the editorial office should be reading it at this stage. So there was already this huge enthusiasm for it. And I suddenly realized I'm very lucky to have these publishers.
The fact that there are illustrations in it, which I had no idea about when I got the first, the reading edition of it, the pre-publication edition. When you get the hardcover and you see these very atmospheric illustrations by Portia Rosenberg, who was somebody that you must have handpicked to do this, but was that part of your original idea to have it illustrated?
No, it wasn't part of the original idea. During the 10-year period that I was writing, I came across Portia's pictures because she lives in Cambridge, as I do, and I saw her work at an open studio one summer, and I think the first things I saw of hers were illustrations she'd done to Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist and some other illustrations for Cinderella. And I thought it's amazing, because if you've sort of got a computer and went, merge Oliver Twist and Cinderella, you wouldn't be that far away from Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And then my agent said, again, when we were thinking about how we were going to put this to publishers, he said, why not get a few illustrations done? But I think in his mind, it was just to sort of catch a publisher's eye. And I said, that's great, because I know someone who I think will do it. But I was also, at the back of my mind, then thinking, you know, maybe they would actually like to do an illustrated version. So when Bloomsbury bought it, I said, what about the illustrations? And after a little humming and hawing, a very, very little humming and hawing, they said yes, which really took me aback because I thought you're publishing an 800-page book by an unknown author and you want to do illustrations. How hard can you make it for yourself? They were very brave and bold people, I thought.
I want to remind people we're going to take some questions in a little while. We're going to adjust the microphone, so start thinking of them because I will turn to you shortly. I know you've talked about what's going to happen after this book. There are a lot of us who really want to see some of these characters again. It's very hard to let go of some of them. I I'd like to hear more from the Raven King, John Usglass. I don't know if I'm ever going to see him again. I'm sure I'm going to see Strange again. He and his wife, Arabella, she didn't want to go into the dark tower of the night with him. Why not? Was she just really ticked off that he didn't rescue her sooner? You've left us kind of hanging in a very odd sort of magical cliffhanger, and I didn't realize it would be that way. But after you're through with it, the book isn't really over.
I think I always knew that when I ended it, I thought it was unlikely that it would end with all the ends tied up and everything, everybody back to their rightful place, because life is not like that. So even when I thought this, as I often did, that this would be the only novel that I ever wrote, then I thought there is going to be some uncertainties at the end, because I think that is the sort of natural ending for me to write as a writer. But now that I have the opportunity to write another book, I shall be able to take some of this a bit further. But it will be a book about the same world, but I think it will be concentrating on other characters. It won't just be it won't be the continuing story of Strange and Nora, but some of the old characters will turn up again.
If anybody wants to ask a question, just stand up in front of the microphone. Come on down. Don't be shy. I can just keep going forever. But I know that other people, if you've read the book, you can't help but have a lot of questions about it. Well, thank you. Great. Please be my guest.
Thank you. As she's already mentioned, I think there's a lot of people who like the gentleman with the thistle-down hair. And I'm curious about the identity of him. Was he based on any particular mythology?
He wasn't, and in actual fact, I only had a name for him at the beginning, and then I realized that name was wrong. I also realized...
Wait, what was the name?
I was going to call him Tamlin, but then which is the name of a human in a fairy, in a ballad who gets stolen away by fairies. So it was the wrong sort of associations. But one of the things... The reason why he never gets a name, and the reason why I never say too much about him, was this idea that if you have the name of a magical or supernatural being, you have some power over them. And he was far too clever, I think, to let anyone who he thought was at all dangerous to him to let them know his name. And I think that's why he goes without a name. So there were a lot of sort of little elements of fairy folk tales that went to make him up, but no one source.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the York magicians, because it begins with the York magicians and they're destroyed and then they're brought back sort of at the end. I wondered, it kind of felt to me like it was part of the continuing connection of English magic to the English people. I wonder if maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's. The book is about English magic, and for the period of the book, English magic gets concentrated on these two magicians, Strange and Norrell. But in its past history, it's been a thing that's belonged, as you say, to Englishmen generally, and hopefully the return of the York magicians may help continue that tradition at the end. It's also about returning to Northern England, because Northern England in the novel is the place from which English magic stems. And the book begins in the north of England, but then because in the Regency period all of government was centred in London, it actually the focus goes away from Northern England, but it's able to return at the end. So that's another good reason for going back to the York magicians.
Thank you.
Sorry, a two-part question. A lot of people have talked about this book as an adult Harry Potter, as you mentioned. I wonder how you feel about that comparison. And secondly, both this and J.K. Rowling's book talk about a very British magic. It's English magic. And there's something sort of compelling about that. And I'm wondering if there's some sort of thing you think that's going on in the collective British psyche that this is sort of symbolic of or somehow reflective of.
The Rowling, the comparison with Harry Potter doesn't bother me at all. I've now completed reading the Harry Potter books. I thought they were I really enjoyed it. I thought they were absolutely fantastic. Who would mind being compared to something so successful and so good? I don't know that it's incredibly useful as a comparison, because I think the style and even the form of magic in the books is so different. As regards English magic, it's very odd. I mean, I did a day of interviews in Amsterdam, and a Dutch journalist said, "I always associate magic with England." And I said, "Really? Because you actually have a stronger tradition of fairies and folklore in Europe than we have remaining to us in England." And she said, "Yes, I know, but I still associate magic with England." And I think it's simply to do with the fact that we've now got quite a strong tradition of fantasy and magical writers. I mean, from the Arthurian myths onward, they're just, and then Shakespeare and the Elizabethan fairy writers. For some reason, English writers have been drawn to fantasy and magic, and now there is a tradition there.
Well, Merlin, if somebody asked somebody before Merlin Harry
Welsh.
Potter, well, okay. We think
definitely
of him as English.
Welsh. Definitely. Don't say
here
that
in America,
to a Welshman.
I know. It's very ignorant, but...
No, I'm for your own good. You need this information.
There were times I thought of this book as almost like a reference document, with the way that there's such a huge backstory and the footnotes constantly draw out like this very long historical record. And you mentioned writing a lot of that as a personal thing to kind of flesh it out in your head. Was there a point at which you kind of just sat down and said, okay, there's going to be the way there's three periods of magicians and there's certain names associated with each and certain histories associated with each. Was there a point where you just kind of sat down and just fleshed that out, or like kind of wrote that out, or was it something that just happened very spontaneously? Could you write a little bit, could you talk a little bit more about that?
The magical history grew organically, yes. At the very beginning, I had the Raven King at one end, and I had these two characters, Strange and Norrell, at the other end, and I sort of thought, and there'll be a lot of other magicians in between. And then gradually I thought, well, you know, if you have a lot of artists, or you have a lot of poets or whatever it is, then they get divided up into schools and periods. So obviously they would be sort of there would be different names that were given to people at different times. So that's when you get the three types of magicians, the Aureates, the Argentines, and the Moderns. And so you just sort of constantly added as much scholarly apparatus as you could to make it seem more real. That was always the thing that I tried to do, to sort of make it seem as real as it could to somebody with a peculiar imagination like mine.
Before we take another question, it's interesting that there are actually a lot of art references in the book, both obliquely, and people might be reminded of in your descriptions by Piranesi or Di Chirico or Salvador Dali. But you actually have Jonathan Strange at one point saying that magicians are like artists because they impose their own design on yeah. the world. And so it's interesting to me that you keep making these references to the arts, basically.
Yeah, I have got a series of quite strong visual images in my head of this world, and a lot of them are drawn from particular artists. Piranesi is definitely one. I think with any story, or often when I'm writing a story, there is a sort of, there's a visual feel for it. I mean, this one had lots of visual feels, but I mean, I know that for a next piece of work that I'm doing, I'm collecting pictures and stuff on other artists, because that seems appropriate to that story. So,
well, you specifically mentioned Goya as painting, making a drawing, you know, in part of his Disasters of War series. Yeah. You inject Jonathan Strange into that, and there's a lot of portraiture, and it's obvious that you do have a real active visual memory.
Yes.
Maybe this is from editing all those cookbooks that you did.
way before then.
We have, I think, time for one more question.
Sorry, it's a two-part question. And thank you for such a phenomenal read. I'm only surprised at how quickly, and I'm not a little bit annoyed at how quickly I finished it. I think it's an inevitable question. Have you been approached about a movie, and how do you feel about that? And would you give your hand at potentially doing the screen adaptation? And without giving too much away for those who haven't read it, could you explain if and why not Stephen and Lady Pale couldn't write of their entire... It seems perfectly logical to me why they couldn't explain it, but why they couldn't write of it.
Oh, I'd never thought of that. Right, the movie. The movie has been optioned by New Line. I mean, I think that you just, as a writer, you just have to regard the film, if it ever happens, as a separate thing. And to hope it goes well. It's not going to be the same as the book, but the book will always be there. So, you know, and that's the thing I worked on. I wouldn't ever attempt a screenplay. It's not my sort of streamlining and cutting back and doing a sort of pared back story is obviously not my talent. So I'm not going to do that. Stephen and Lady Pole. I think the same restrictions would have applied to writing as applied to speech, so it just wouldn't have worked, I'm afraid.
It's interesting that so many people really bought into your idea of the book and what went into it and these characters. And you say that it's not like a Trekkie convention yet, but I see this in your future. There are going to be Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell conventions, and people are going to be dressed up as the man with thistle down hair, and then it's going to become this, you know, every Halloween we're going to have to see it. And you must have a certain number of nutcases coming out of the woodwork after you.
I know, I really don't.
You probably wouldn't recognize them.
No, maybe not. No, the audiences that have come to my readings and that sort of thing, the main thing that I've found really wonderful about them is that I get such a huge range of people. I get people who love fantasy. I get people who've never read a fantasy book. I get grandmothers. I get grandfathers. I get a few kids, and I get everybody in between. I think, an equal balance of men and women, which is great, because I was doing a reading with Emma Donoghue, who's written Life Mask, the Irish writer who lives in Canada, and she said, we did two readings. And the second one, she said, Susanna, you get a lot of these young male geeks in black. And I said, yeah, but they only turn up, Emma, when you're here. So, you know, it's obviously a symbiotic thing we've got going between the two. Generally, my audiences are really mixed, which is wonderful. But really, no nutcases that I can see.
Well, I hope we don't have to wait 10 years for the next one. I kind of figure we're not going to have to.
I hope so, too. I don't think it'll take me that long.
Will you come back to Chicago and see
us
again? Well, I really want to thank Susanna Clark, who has written Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman, joint project of Chicago Magazine and 98.7 WFMT Radio here at Looking Glass Theater. Please come back here January 23rd for Alexander Heyman, and get on our email list, and we'll tell you about the upcoming season. And please join us out in the lobby where you can buy a copy, have your book signed, and schmooze her. Thank you very much.
A contributor to WTTW 11 Chicago Tonight and Artbeat, and also seen on CBS2's Eye on Chicago, Victoria Loutman, the host of Writers on the Record, has written articles for the Chicago Tribune, USA Today, The Reader, and the Chicago Sun-Times. She has been the Chicago editor for Metropolitan Home, Art and Auction, and Architectural Record, and has also contributed pieces to Interview, HG, El Decor, Architectural Digest, and many other magazines. To be in the audience for next month's live broadcast with author Alexander Heyman, Sunday, January 23rd at noon from the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks at 821 North Michigan, reserve a free ticket by phoning 312-832-6789. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Jacqueline Russell, General Manager David Schmitz, and Director of Production Lee Potter Murray, and to Chicago Magazine, including editor Richard Babcock. Technical production was by Eric Arunas. The director was Dennis Moore. And the executive producer of Writers on the Record is Steve Robinson. The Stuart Brent Children's Book Club hopes you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman. According to 6-year-old Clara, I love it, I love it, I love it. Imagine, it is a book. The Stuart Brent Children's Book Club knows it's on to something big when glowing testimonials such as Clara's arrive every day. Because, as every parent knows, books are the stuff of love. Sharing your love of books is at the heart of the Stuart Brent Children's Book Club, where books are individually selected and mailed to each child's home. What better way to build a library? To learn more about this unique, highly personalized service, check out stuartbrent.com for more kid testimonials, the book club's monthly newsletter, and enrollment information. Feel free to explore and don't hesitate to call toll-free 888-742-3207. Inspire a lifelong love of learning and reading with the Stuart Brent Children's Book Club. Phone 888-742-3207. This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago, a service of Network Chicago.